Good morning. I'm Joe Donahue. Welcome to the Roundtable, and it's very nice to be with you for this Thursday morning. It is the 24th of April. Very nice to have you all with us, and I appreciate you you coming to your radios in whatever way you are coming to your radios, whether it be through through streaming or through the ever popular download later, the podcasting feature, or listening to us live in your home or your automobile. We have a great group today. Let me talk to you about who they are. I'll introduce them to you. We welcome you as well, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Bo Breslin is here, Joseph Palamountain, Jr., Chair in Government at Skidmore College. A newbie, this is his second appearance on the program, and we couldn't be more thrilled to have Bo with us. Good morning, Bo. How are you?
Morning, Joe. I'm great. Thanks.
It's really nice to have you here. Now, I was saying this earlier, but Bo was here last week, and we also had on three college students, so he totally got usurped. Like, it was just overshadowed to the nth degree. So I look forward to having just a show where we can we can focus on your bonus. We welcome the wonderful Judy Patrick to the program, former vice president for editorial development at the New York Press Association, former longtime editor of the Daily Gazette. I guess, I was right, former vice president for editorial development.
Indeed.
That's right. Good morning.
Good morning. You know, it's nice to hear Joe Palamountain's name. I covered Saratoga Springs for a long time years ago, and he was president of Skidmore College. Very, very nice guy, very astute, and led the college through some interesting times. So he's an august person that I think fondly of.
Yeah, he's great. It's been nice to have his chair.
We also welcome, and it's been a while, it seems like it's been a long time since I've seen you. And I've missed you horribly, so it's wonderful to see you.
Shucks.
Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. How are you?
I'm okay.
Good. Excellent. We start off with the news of the day, because what else are we going to do? And we're it's our news, and we're stuck with it. And we welcome your thoughts, as always, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. And all kinds of things going on, and I think we'll start a little bit with the whether there seems to be a some controversy over the term did Trump blink when it comes to the economy. On major economic decisions, Trump blinks and then blinks again. President Trump has said his tariffs would force companies to build factories in the U.S. It's far from clear that they will have the effects that he predicted, and this was after a fairly disastrous week in which he began by saying that he wanted to get rid of the chair of the Federal Reserve, and also something that he really can't do from the best of our knowledge. And then the markets tanked, and then the tariffs with China and the markets tanked. And then suddenly he said, I have no intention of firing Jerome Powell. And then he also said that we are working with China to de-escalate. The David Sanger, who is a writer for the New York Times, says, after weeks of bluster and escalation, Mr. Trump blinked, then he blinked again and again. He backed off his threat to fire the Federal Reserve chairman, his Treasury secretary, acutely aware that the S&P 500 was down 10% since Mr. Trump was inaugurated, signaled he was looking for an off-ramp to avoid an intensifying trade war with China. And now Mr. Trump has acknowledged that the 145% tariffs on Chinese goods that he announced just 2 weeks ago are not sustainable. He was prompted in part by the warnings of senior executives from Target and Walmart and other large American retailers that consumers would see prices surge and empty shelves for some important goods within just a few weeks. Mr. Trump's encounter with reality amounted to a vivid case study in the political and economic costs of striking the hardest of hard lines. He entered this trade war imagining a simpler era in which imposing punishing tariffs would force companies around the world to build factories in the United States of America. He ends the month discovering that the world of modern supply chains is far more complex than he bargained for, and that it is far from clear his, quote, beautiful tariffs will have the effects that he predicted. Bo, we'll start with you.
Did he blink? Yes. Did he blink again? Yes. Joe, he blinks many times. And I think I would call it slightly different than Sanger called it. I would call it impulse governance, right? He goes about his business in such a way that he makes impulse buys, impulse decisions, and that sort of thing. And then the pendulum inevitably is going to swing back towards the middle. And I don't think I think Sanger's right. He blinked, especially with regard to China. Reducing the tariffs or talking about reducing the tariffs, he obviously did. I think he blinks with foreign diplomacy as well. I think it's, you know, when you talk about Ukraine, which we can talk about down the road, I think that there's a blink too. And ultimately, I think in this sort of situation, he is, as I said, he's sort of impulse governing. The reality is that he has to sort of figure out how to avoid the chaos that is that's going on in the White House and in the executive branch, and think differently about the way he goes about business. And I'll say one more thing. The thing that frustrates me the most about this is the fact that we're getting outmaneuvered. We're getting outmaneuvered in the economy. This is a Liz Truss moment. We're getting outmaneuvered in the diplomatic arena. President Xi and President Putin are winning this game. And so it's not surprising to me that Putin bombed Kyiv overnight. It's so predictable the way in which Vance and Rubio sort of said, we're going to take our toys and leave the negotiating table. So this pendulum swing, this blink, this impulse governance, this is part of the problem with the Trump administration. And there was a sense that maybe the Trump 2.0 was going to be a little bit different than Trump 1.0, but I'm afraid that's just not the case. I think it's exactly the same sort of situation, and I call it impulse governance.
The point I would like to get to is, and I want to hear from everybody else as well, but before we do that, the necessity of doing what was done in the first place. I mean, look at the case of the economy, the state of the economy, as the president came in late January 2025, right. and was it necessary to do what we did and to be to go on the journey that we went on over the last several right. weeks?
Yeah, so I think the answer is no. I mean, I think rational politics would say no, Joe, to that. But there's nothing rational about what goes on in the executive branch and in the White House at the moment. So I honestly believe this is a Liz Truss moment. So you'll remember back in 2022 when when Great Britain went through three prime ministers in the span of 50 days. Liz Truss tried to reshape the world economy with, and especially the domestic economy in Britain, by promising massive tax cuts at the same time that she was going to promise increased government spending. Those two don't go together. And her point was to not just disrupt, but create a new economic world order in the UK, and it blew up in her face, right? The only difference between that situation and our situation is the UK parliamentary system says you can replace Liz Truss. We can't replace Trump at the moment, but Trump is trying to not just disrupt the world economic order, but reshape it in a way that these tariffs were sort of the centerpiece of his reshaping of of the economic world order, and it blew up in his face. So was it preventable? Yes, but it's not preventable for someone who goes in thinking they're going to try to reshape the world order and doesn't really think about the consequences down the road.
One of the things, Judy, that I find fascinating about this is that there's an expectation that these companies who have moved overseas are going to come back to the United States and they're going to open up their factories and hire American workers, and suddenly all of those jobs that are overseas are going to come back to America. And that didn't happen in 5 weeks.
we got no big announcements of anything that happening.
You know, that's not long ball, right? I mean, that's we're gonna wait. Oh, okay, this isn't working.
I think we all want him to take this off ramp we talk about, is, you know, and to have this end. But I fear. I mean, I saw the headline on David Sanger's piece, which said he blinks and blinks again. He's going to see that headline, of course, and he's going to. And if you know his personality, and I think we all know how he works now, he will be intransigent on this one. He's not going to move. He doesn't like to be perceived as a fool. I mean, you hear him say repeatedly, "We are the laughingstock." Well, he doesn't want to be the laughingstock, and he is being the laughingstock. And I think his only recourse is to keep with these 145% tariffs. I think the world economic order is more difficult to operate than buying a piece of real estate in New Jersey and Manhattan, and he has just not come down to realize that yet, and he's never going to realize it.
And the world knows that.
Yes.
But his base doesn't realize. I mean, he's doing what he was elected to do, which is to disrupt. And people in America think that these ideas are good ideas because they're not economic analysis. They're not. You need. There is a reason why presidents have cabinets and advisors. There is a reason why these decisions take time. And I think Americans get bored. Our attention span is short. And when things are stable, we feel like something's wrong. And so the disruption, the chaos, that's exactly what his supporters want, because they think it will change something for their day to day. They think that maybe if we just do something other than what the experts tell us to, that the price of eggs will go down. Right. And he capitalizes on that and goes with his agenda, which is to capture the American imagination and stay in power as long as humanly possible, to stash away money in his pockets and for his friends. The blink is not because he's learning anything in public, which, like, what a mortifying way to earn an economics degree. It's that he is somehow suffering in terms of his own ambition or agenda. And so I think the key is to figure out what that is, because it's not anything legitimately to do with the global economic order.
It seems to me, and I may have this wrong, I may be reading this wrong, but it seems when Scott Bessent had the meeting with J.P. Morgan mm-hmm. the other day, and that was a private meeting. But you know, couples who have the signal that when they tap their head three times, it's time to go. You know, we got to get out of this conversation and just head to the car. And as he was saying, you know, we don't seem this plan, the sustainability is questionable over time. It was the head tap, right? It was we got to get out of this. And it wasn't an indictment of Trump. It wasn't an indictment of the policies, but it certainly was an understanding that, okay, we're on the same page as you all are.
Right. And I think I think Bessent is the best that they have up there. That's part of the trouble here is that, I know, we're all excited about Bessent being the best that they have up there. It's a low bar. That said, it's the same sort of situation, Joe, I think, with international affairs, right? That is, you know, there's the head tap to get out of there. And sometimes that head tap is the smart move. I think in Bessent's case, it was the smart move. And sometimes the head tap to get out of the party is a mistake. And so I always equate it. These things all connect to each other, right? They're all part of the Trump the Trump fabric of governance. And when J.D. Vance and Marco Rubio both say within an hour or two of each other that we're leaving the table on Europe, Ukraine, and Russia, that's the tap to get out of it too. But that's a mistake. That one's a mistake. And right. So the negotiation about how to move forward a Trump agenda when Trump himself doesn't know what the agenda is ends up being just utterly problematic, both for us, our allies, our enemies. The world order is scratching its head. And quite frankly, we all should be tapping our heads and getting out of the party.
Well, and this just happens to be the headline on CNN right now, but it was I was reading an interesting article about this earlier today, I believe from the Wall Street Journal, that the Trump administration is saying that they're having meetings every day with China regarding the tariffs. China says, "No, you're not."
Right.
They're not. Now, I don't know who to believe in that. I have no idea. But it just it seems to be that maybe it's difficult for us, the American people, to fully believe that there is meaningful tariff negotiations going on when one party is like, yeah, we're not doing anything.
Yeah. Last week, NBC report or the Trump administration said they had gotten calls from 75 countries. NBC asked for a list of all 75 countries, and they never got that list. I mean, this is I think Trump supporters admire their bravado. They admire mm-hmm. the bully at work. And as soon as yesterday, I heard Trump supporters saying, yeah, there's going to be a little upheaval. We just have to hold the line. And, you know, there's some grand plan in his head that we admire, and this is going to happen, and we're all going to be better off for it.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. We welcome your letters. panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. Bo Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Sarah Rogerson with us on this Thursday morning. We welcome you, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. Couple of letters to look at. One from Ellen, imperative to treat everyone with respect, always and critically weigh all possible variables before taking action. Seek and incorporate input from key experts because we are each human and are subject to human error. Trump incorporates none of these dictums.
Right. I've heard him say he reacts from his gut. It's his gut instinct where he does this or that. And he said it repeatedly, so it's not like he's taking in that kind of advice from experts and weighing the different options. I think he's had success with that on a political level, getting elected twice. So I think he thinks that's going to work with him when he's buying a piece of real estate in New Jersey or Manhattan.
It seems that the discussions that are happening, though, on just in economic circles as well as on cable news shows far and wide, is the long-term impact on the economy and what is happening as a result of the chaos, which I believe is the correct term, the chaos that we have seen over the last several weeks.
Yeah, I mean, I think the long-term impact of this, you know, that's the funny thing about this, Joe, is when it comes to the economy and when it comes to politics, it's human behavior. So it's actually hard to really pinpoint exactly what's going to happen. But you've said it a lot of times on the roundtable, chaos is not good for economic growth in the country. Chaos is not good for stability and security across the world. Chaos is not good for border security or civil rights and civil liberties. So, you know, I was thinking about this. We have to, where are the Democrats in this? And what's the plan for, what's the long-term plan for the Democratic Party when it comes to responding to all of the things that are happening? Right now, the only game in town, I think, is the right-wing Republican game. And at some point, especially as we get closer to the midterms, we have to have focused and, I think, energized response from the Democratic Party that is unified as opposed to split.
Yeah, I'm hopeful in some respects that this is inspiring some deep covert resistance inside the White House. People who actually know what the real world impact is of Trump's behavior and are doing their best to keep the guardrails in place in some way, shape, or form. But unfortunately, for the broader public interest, things aren't going to change until something really bad happens. I mean, the last time we were able to, well, one of the last times we were able to unify as a country was 9/11. And right. I was reminded of that when I was in Manhattan last week. And, you know, it reminded me of that time. And that's unfortunately sort of what I fear, is that something will happen in the next 4 years in the absence of an ability and really sort of overt chilling of public resistance in a really targeted way. There's been a lot of public calls and op-eds and otherwise by people like David Brooks saying, like, this is the moment. We are here. This isn't an experiment. This isn't a bump in your 401k. This is a real serious problem. And, you know, I don't know where we are in terms of that sort of covert, coordinated resistance, but it's going to have to be bipartisan in order for the guardrails to stay in place.
I think too many Democrats are still taking the approach of, well, we'll let them fail really badly and then we're going to step up. Yeah. But I see the impact of that is the fact that the Democrats are losing their base. Yeah. I mean, average Democrats are being disillusioned by the fact that the leaders of their party are not more forcefully stepping up and saying this every single thing. There's time in the day to speak out on all the things that are happening, from the deportation of people without due process to trying to strong arm universities into teaching the courses they want taught. I mean, where are the Democrats? You see a few of them, but you do not see a strong united effort. You see this in the polls. The new Siena poll out today showed, you know, a dramatic decline in support from Democrats of what the congressional Democrats are doing to fight back.
And it's hard for me to believe, Judy, that the most popular Democrats at the moment are Bernie Sanders and AOC,
yeah.
Right? At the end of the day, sure, I can get behind Bernie Sanders and AOC, but the far left progressive wing of the Democratic Party should not be the one that's driving the conversation, and so far they're the only ones talking.
And maybe they should. I mean, maybe what we're seeing too is the truth about American Democrats, that the mainstream Democratic movement lost touch with people a long time ago, didn't in fact go far enough, didn't exhibit bravery when they had the chance. The leadership in particular, starting, well, more recently with the selection of Joe Biden as the Democratic candidate. I mean, like, in the year, you know, in the time that we're in now, the Democrats could have been a lot more progressive in a lot of ways. And out of fear of what might happen, we had a lot of pearl-clutching moderate Dems who towed the Republican lines, and we lost as a result.
That idea of the fear of what was going to happen, that is the part I don't get. Like, this seems to me, we talk a lot in this show about low-hanging fruit. But for the Democrats to get up their gumption and complain about something, there's a lot of low-hanging fruit to, like, just grab, put in a bushel basket, and
sure.
just start launching it.
Yeah.
And that's what I don't understand.
You know, and the listeners to this program do not like it when we criticize the Democratic Party and their lack of inaction. But it comes from a place of constructive criticism. I mean, we believe in democracy.
It comes from a place of love.
I mean, our two-party system is invaluable to our society. Remember Cory Booker's 25-hour speak? Mm-hmm. I mean, there was nothing more clear to me of how out of touch the Democratic power structure was when Chuck Schumer stepped in at the last minute to tell Cory Booker he had broken the record. I just thought it was a cringe moment. I think there are cringe moments all around on the upper echelon of the Democratic Party. They need a revision of their entire approach.
But I was not hosting the day after that. You were on the show that day. Mm-hmm. And I was just sort of mesmerized, appalled by how many people were saying, well, you know, that doesn't do any good.
Oh, I love the speech.
Oh, yeah, like that doesn't do any good. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, but it's something.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's something. Yeah. And it not only is it something, it is, it doesn't have to be the only thing.
Right.
That's the thing. It doesn't have to be it. But it is something, and it's sending up a flare.
Well, for 25 hours, Cory Booker captured a significant chunk of the American imagination to remind us of our origin story in its complexity and its failings, but really sort of like recenter the moral compass of the Democratic Party or inspire people to remember where they came from. Sort of, you know, he's a big Star Trek fan, Star Wars, so it's just sort of like that idea, like, remember who you are, Luke, or I don't know, there's like a ton of yeah. these references, superhero references, but it goes back to you know, the Democrats kneeling wearing kente cloths, right? You remember that moment? That was like beyond cringeworthy of like the Democrat. And Trump supporters are not wrong when they say that liberal elites are out of touch. That's not wrong.
Right.
And so when Trump does what he does and it looks more familiar, I mean, it's like your off the rails uncle, you know, all of a sudden getting all the power of the American government and doing what that seems more familiar to the American public in terms of like what their comfort level than a bunch of people who have not exhibited that they understand the everyday struggle of everyday Americans doing weird performative stuff. There's a big difference between Democrats kneeling in 2020 and what Cory did. What remains to be seen is if anybody's going to do anything with what Cory did. The Democrats sort of thought this was like an inoculation or a shot in the arm and like, okay, we'll do this thing. Cory will be our hero. And then Americans will just, I don't know, fall in line.
Right.
But that didn't happen.
Yeah, it has to be. It has to be consistent. one after another, and right, more and more people doing something.
Because Cory's still doing his stuff. I mean, but like, it's going to take more than one person.
Well, let me be shamefully, I'll admit, a liberal elite, right, and say
and we all are.
I know, and say, you know, the problem is also messaging. And when the Republican Party has essentially a single message, which is the message of fear, well, we can make it broad, right? It's the message of fear. It's the message of otherness. It's the message of that you've been oppressed for too long. This is the sort of Trump playbook. When that message is simple, and the Democratic Party doesn't have a simple message in response. And so right now, sure. I mean, I think it's fair to say that just simply because of the nature of American politics, that come next November, the Democrats are going to pick up 40 or 50 seats in the House of Representatives. I'm sure of that. I'm not sure they'll win the Senate. But as you see by unitary executive theory a la Trump, the presidency really does matter. And so Congress, these are professional politicians, oftentimes they're going to shrug. It will help to have a Congress, House of Representatives, with a majority Democratic Party. But the real prize is the presidency, and we have yet to figure out what we're going to say as Democrats on that stage.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. All right, we have letters. We'll go to them now and see what's on your mind. Paul says Dems are completely powerless at this time. Got any more? Oh, I'm sorry. That's a quote. Dems are completely powerless at this time. That was said. The response from Paul. Got any more Republican talking points? Biden administration led the world out of the pandemic maze to investing in U.S. infrastructure and more. Elites are educated and knowledgeable people. We want that type of leadership. Okay, but I will throw it back to the letter writer, to Paul, and say, okay, then why is the power then not being used by the Democrats?
Right. Or and the fact that, okay, elites are the smart people and we should let the country be run by elites. But guess what? Everybody gets to vote, and not everybody. And so people who are non-elites get to vote too. So you need to involve them in the process, and you need to take their concerns into account as well. I can remember someone saying, you know, the elite people, they just don't like us. They put us down all the time. It's something we really need to tackle as a country, the fact that a significant portion of the people we live with believe we put them down all the time. In many cases, they're racist and sexist. I mean, we have to admit that there is the undercurrent of that we need to address. But there are ways of addressing it that the Democrats need to devise. And it's not just, you know, Cory Booker's speech was great, but there are other things they could do. I mean, Schumer could do other things. He doesn't have to, you know, he's been very effective in New York State at going to every county. I mean, he could do. There are things people can do besides big, long speeches. Bernie Sanders never is hardly ever cringeworthy. I mean, he's a meme maker.
You know, I'm admittedly going somewhat off on a tangent here, but when Bill Maher, the comedian, went to visit with the president of the United States with Kid Rock, let that stand in the air for a moment, and then went on his program and gave his book report, as he called it, and said, and the reason I'm bringing this up, and said, we have to stop just going and talking into the wind for 25 hours. We have to go and meet these people where they are, and stop yelling at each other. And boy, that struck me. And I thought, well, what's this doing? Like, what is this doing? And I was really turned off by it. And, to the point where when Larry David wrote his article, his letter about, having lunch with Hitler, I just thought, well, yeah, you nailed it. But it's interesting to me that there is a perspective even within, and I would put Bill Maher labels himself this way as a Democratic centrist, that I mean that's part of the problem too, of thinking that by having a conversation that is supposed to be lucid and constructive is probably not going to happen.
Well, not with those people.
Right.
So,
right.
Like, there's wisdom in lived experience. There are lots of reasonable people who voted for Trump. That is the truth. They are not monogamous. They are not uniform monogamous. they're not uniform in belief.
Monogamy may vary.
Everyone in America is talking about each other right now in terms of politics is really, really broken, because you know there are misogynists and racists in the Democratic Party, right? And the labeling and the lack of sophistication with which we have these conversations, and then the sensationalism of having them with people who have no place, you know, in that conversation, really, other than drawing attention to themselves, which I'm not putting Corey in that bucket. But the real work happens when we talk to each other. And it's not like the performative, like, oh, I'm a liberal Democrat and I'm going to go across the street to my Trump flag waving neighbor and try to break bread. That's not what I'm talking about. That might not be successful. I'm talking about everyday interactions and thinking about how you situate yourself in the American public as it is, and sort of like the everyday interactions.
Yeah.
Bo?
Yeah. So, Sarah, I agree. Let me approach it two ways, Joe, on this. One is, you know, there's a reason why Robert Putnam's Bowling Alone resonates with people, mm-hmm. right? The fact of the matter is we don't do bowling leagues anymore, and that's where we got a sense of what it was to be an American, to understand difference and recognize that, you know, your Muslim neighbor has a lived experience, too. So, you know, I'm all for that. I also want to approach this. The second thing I'll say, Joe, is I also want to approach this from a different angle, and that is an angle of strategy, right? Mm-hmm. So for the Democratic Party, one of the things that I think they're wrestling with at the moment, and I'm a Democrat, so I'm wrestling with it too, is this idea that if there's any significant long-term impact on American politics from the Trump administration, it's that the game of politics and campaigning has changed. And the Democratic Party, imagine that the game was basketball in the Obama administration, and now the game is tiddlywinks. The Democratic Party still wants to get back to basketball. And the reality is the game has changed. So how do you play in a game that you don't want to be part of that game because it's not elegant or it's not elitist or whatever? And I think ultimately the Democratic Party has to figure out that we're A, playing a different game, and B, we have to understand how to play that game. That I don't. That's where I think the hand wringing is happening.
I was at a cocktail party the other night, and two people came up to me and were talking to us about the news and reporting on the stuff and talking about it. And both individuals said that they had been a part of the hands-off rallies that had taken place throughout our communities. And very wistfully, they both looked at me and said, but I don't think it does any good. And I said, but it does it do you good? Like, do you feel, is there an empowerment that comes when you are out there on the street and someone honks their horn in response to what you're doing? Like, we also need coping mechanisms, too. and if being with your friends and community and bonding in that experience, and whether dozens or hundreds, that to me is powerful within. It doesn't even, okay, does it change anything? Maybe not, probably not. But if it gets that person through what we're going through, man, go for it.
Well, there's so many letters all the time. What do we do?
That's right.
We're looking
Absolutely.
Outside of ourselves
we
for
get
solutions.
It 20 times every hour.
And that's the wrong question. It's what can I do?
Yeah.
And there's a really great book by Prentice Hempel called What It Takes to Heal, How Transforming Ourselves Can Change the World. And it's kind of radical. Radical in lots of ways. They were the organizational psychologists, for lack of a better term, for Black Lives Matter during like 2020 to 2024, a time of wild upheavals, regeneration, all kinds of, I'm sure, internal conflict in that organization. But the suggestion is that by really, really focusing on our own values and beliefs and getting right with ourselves, that it changes how we interact with each other in a way that is more dynamic and powerful than any Facebook rant that might make you feel better for 30 seconds after it's done, right? It's this idea that we're going to be very performative. We want everybody to know where we stand, and then we want a leader to tell us what to do. That's over. Yeah. We don't live there anymore.
Exactly
it's on
right.
us. So we have to get right with ourselves and then with our neighbors. It can be as simple as having somebody who's working on your house starting a conversation with them. I found out that Bill, my tub guy, is really upset with Trump, and I did not expect that at all.
Right.
And for reasons that I could not have predicted. And that made me feel good for like a week.
Yeah.
My conversation
yeah.
with Bill the Tub
yeah.
Guy. And it changed how I think about the way that I speak publicly on these issues.
Did he have thoughts on the whole showerhead thing?
No, I love that, Sarah. And I agree completely. I'll throw this one thing in there, and that is this the question of leadership that you're talking about. You know who's really smart about what we can do together is Chris Murphy, right?
He yes.
yeah.
he understands that what's happening are these subtle changes about things like voting. And so we as a collective polity, right, a collective community of folks can pay attention and make waves on those real nuanced and subtle ways in which the Republican Party primarily is making changes to the way we can voice our opinion and vote.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll get to some listener letters, move on to other topics, and include you into the discussion. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We welcome you. First, some messages and then news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. A good one going. We have Bo Breslin here, the Joseph Palamountain Jr. Chair in Government at Skidmore College in Saratoga Springs, former Vice President for Editorial Development at the New York Press Association and former longtime editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. Judy Patrick is here, and Albany Law School professor and director of the Justice Center, Sarah Rogerson. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll move on to other topics, but I do want to get to some letters from listeners. Cynthia writes, democracy is not elitist. Democracy is for every man and woman. The Republicans are taking your rights and freedoms away. Democracy is our short, concise message. Anti-autocracy is our short, concise message. We don't want to be a Putin satellite. That from Cynthia. We then go to Jim. I'm a middle-class union guy who wants his kids to be able to buy a house. The Democrats need to show me the path to achieve that.
Exactly.
Charlie writes, the problem as I see it is the progressives and liberal elites, quote unquote, are trying to drive the base rather than letting the base drive the party's direction.
Also true.
Smart.
That seems like that's been a complaint, though, for like the beginning of time, right? I mean, like
yeah.
political time, you
yeah.
know, that's I don't disagree with the message. I'm just saying it's a time-honored concern. Debbie says they should focus and highlight the Trump administration's corruption over and over every day by every Democrat. There is certainly enough material. This is what we were talking about earlier about low-hanging fruit. But Randy says, stop rehashing. Joe Biden on a ventilator would be better than what we have now. Well, yes, but Joe Biden isn't the president of the United States, nor is Kamala Harris the vice or the president of the United States.
No, we lost the House and the Senate and everything.
I don't know. I understand the point, but we're not rehashing. We're talking about what's happening at this moment, just at this very, very, very moment, which could or could not be pivotal as it comes to whatever is going to happen next year in the midterms.
Right. We have to talk about what got us to this place in order to not go to this place again. Right. It's as simple as that.
We go to Patrick. I am an independent who enjoys listening to the roundtable. I have voted third party for many years, and as bad as it is now, I still would not vote for a Democrat. My choice may never win, but I cannot vote simply for the lesser of two evils. Then we check in with Pam. I can't believe the criticism of Democrats this morning. What did you expect with this president? Congress and Supreme Court. They're speaking out. They are organized and working every day to get power back. What are you on the panel doing? Well, I think we're talking about the issues. But I also, I think that, and Sarah pointed this out a moment ago, and I thought beautifully about, yeah, that question is so often, what can we do? And then, yeah, what can I do?
Yeah, well, or who's going to tell us what to do?
Yeah.
More
yeah.
specifically.
That's right.
And it's sort of like everybody on this panel is doing their own part. Part of being on this panel is doing that part. Every day I'm on here, I think, why am I going on the radio?
Why am I working for free?
Like, why? And it's not an insignificant chunk of the day. And so part of it is that it helps me focus my news intake. One of the things that I've done since the first Trump administration is really, really focus where I'm gathering information and ensuring that those are multiple outlets, multiple points of view, sort of actively seeking out and then contributing to the conversation in ways that are constructive as opposed to the call-out culture that has sort of dominated our social media landscape for the better part of the last decade.
We go to Chris. He says, I can't help but think Trump's ability to resist consequences made the Dems gun-shy. After all, they tried to hold him to account in Trump's first term via multiple impeachment attempts to have him be reelected. Luke says, please realize the Democrats are not the answer. There are more independent voters than there are registered Democrats and Republicans combined. Both parties beg for the independent vote in every election. The solution is a third party that actually represents the moderate majority.
Our system doesn't allow for the third parties, unfortunately. The first-past-the-post election system, the fact that the First Amendment doesn't allow us to have religious parties. You know, it's I'm as frustrated as that letter writer is about the lack of choice.
Tony says, tariffs are working. Honda has canceled plans for a factory in Mexico and will now build a new plant here. Apple is investing $500 million in the U.S. along with other companies. Give tariffs a chance and stop hating on Trump. That is from Tony. We go to Ellen. Imperative to treat everyone with respect, always and critically weigh all possible. I think I read that letter.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. Okay. Then we are all caught up. Thank you very much for your letters. We welcome them. Panel at WAMC.org. Panel at WAMC.org. So we move on to other topics. Let's talk about Pete Hegseth because it's been a while, like 24 hours, and we haven't had a conversation. So the latest aspect of the Signal app story is, again, for those of you who are keeping a score at home, there was the first Signal app controversy, which included a journalist from The Atlantic who inadvertently was put onto the Signal conversation, was following and knew what the plans that were being shared were. That brought up grave concerns. Then the New York Times on Sunday published a article saying that not only did that happen, but according to their sources, which included, I believe, people who were let go by Pete Hegseth just hours earlier in a routing of his office, then said that not only that, but he had shared those details on his private phone and to his brother, his lawyer, and his wife. Then yesterday's report was that the consistent message that has come from Hegseth and from the Trump administration is that there was no classified information that was shared. And then it was in an exclusive, I believe, in the Washington Post, said that that information actually came from Central Command and was at that time labeled as classified. So the information that was then shared both on the First Signal app chat and the more personal Signal app chat was confidential and classified. Now, we also learn a little bit more, which is that this from the Washington Post, that Pete Hegseth had Signal messaging app installed on an office computer. And I wish there were a couple of people who are on the show who've worked at the Pentagon, but I find this fascinating of the reasoning here. But one of the reasons is that they had the app on their computers because they don't get cell service in the building.
That's pretty crazy. Yeah.
You would think if you could have a command center that you could get cell service in the building, wouldn't you?
You would think.
But anyway, so that the so that he had a Signal messaging app installed on his computer, again intended because this was used to circumvent a lack of cell phone service, but others say it was to enable easier communication with other Trump officials and to not have to go through the proper protocol. Meanwhile, he stands in that office and continues to be a lightning rod, and he has been very outspoken. He is angry and defiant, and is certainly fighting. But meanwhile, the office still seems to be, meaning his personal office and the central official, what's the word I'm looking for, within the Pentagon, his office,
core
the administrative
leadership?
Office, yes, seems to, is completely in disarray.
Yeah.
And that is, I don't know, seems to me of great concern, but continues to be of great concern and yet is not yet being addressed in any meaningful way.
So, and also, didn't Kristi Noem's purse get stolen with all of her stuff?
$3,000, $4,000 purse, a passport, her phone, and she had Secret Service protection next to her. Just saying.
So, Joe, let's let's talk about numbers a little bit.
Yes.
Okay, so Hegseth is sixth in line for the presidency, right? There is a pecking order among cabinet members, and it's largely based on how long and when the cabinet was established. So Secretary of State is first, and so on. But Hegseth is not that. I'm not suggesting that Hegseth is going to be president. There's a lot of people in front of him. That said, there is an importance to the position. Secondly, I think it's remarkable that we're sitting here and we're sort of waiting to see if Trump replaces the Secretary of Defense on day 94 in an administration. I looked at the numbers. The Brookings Institute did this comparison. 91% of what they describe as the executive branch's A list. These are the top people. 91% of Trump's people in the first administration were replaced. 14 out of the 15 cabinet members. Obama replaced 3 cabinet members, right? So the numbers suggest that this is more than just a silly mistake on Hegseth's part. He's very high up in terms of the. And the fact that we're sitting here thinking about a replacement for that level of cabinet member on day 94 in an administration says to me that we're in some trouble. We're in some serious trouble. I think the numbers suggest something a little bit more interesting than just you just messed up and it's illegal and all that kind of stuff. But ultimately, the numbers say something.
The biggest mistake here is that Hegseth will not admit that he did anything wrong. Right. He will not admit that signaling or telling people when the airplanes were going to leave and what they were going to hit was anything that was that it was wrong of him to send that out. He is clearly not understanding that this is classified information. Indeed, he does understand it, but this is his cover. I mean, Signal is a encrypted app that reporters use a lot, but now I think reporters are probably not going to use it very much anymore because it is not the highest level of encryption you can get, and it's certainly not the level of encryption you need when you are discussing war plans. Donald Trump is not going to give the press, the Democrats, a win on this one. And that is why he is going to stand by Hegseth at least until things cool down. And then maybe he will send him away. I mean, one of the first rules of business is you don't want a lot of turnover. I mean, if you want to run in the private sector, being able to retain, hire good employees and retain them is a sign of a good leader. And so Hegseth needs to be held to account. The Inspector General from the Department of Defense is going to look into this, my understanding is. Mm-hmm. But that's
been going on for a month.
Yeah, and the Democrats do need to not let this one die. There are a lot of things a lot of issues they cannot let die. But this is serious. I mean, it's so clear cut. This was so wrong. And having it on his computer in the office is wrong as well. I almost think that they don't have cell phone service in the Pentagon because the Pentagon should be a space where nothing like that is allowed. I vaguely remember Hillary Clinton talking about how she had to put her private cell phone in some sort of bag and leave it at the door whenever she went to work.
Yonder pouches.
Coming to a high school near you.
That's right. So I heard a commentator talk about this the other – actually, it was John Bolton talk about this. And John Bolton said, well, you usually take the trash out in August. And I thought, wow, is that it, would it really go to August? And that was his contention.
You know, the big defense of Hex at this point is that recruitment is up. I want to see a nice newspaper article about recruitment, where the numbers stand, and what they're doing to recruit young people to join the services. Maybe recruitment is up. It had been lagging. Maybe in this economy, it's the safest place to go.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that's interesting about this moment is that Trump, he clearly had a plan here with his appointments, and the plan was we're going to fill the folks around me, cabinet and otherwise, with individuals who have some media savvy. And Hegseth was the gold standard of that, right? Because he of the Fox News connection. But we're going to fill those who appear well in front of the TV and can speak in a media world. Now, experience be damned, right? You don't have to have the experience. You just have to be good in front of the camera. That's come back to haunt him. I don't want to get us back on this conversation, so let's not get back on this conversation. But all I'll say is a footnote to this, which is that's the game changed, right? The campaign and political game has changed. Are we in a world in which it matters as much, I don't think more, but as much to be media savvy than it does to have necessary experience of running an organization like the Department of Defense?
That'd be a lot easier to take if he was just named the public spokesman of the Defense Department. You know, that would have been a good choice. I mean, although he was on Fox trying to defend himself and he had kind of a meltdown. He did not equip himself well when he was trying to defend what he had done and basically just blaming anybody who leaked the information about his inappropriate use of Signal.
And the two keys to that to me were, one, He did not deny that he shared the information, number one.
I'll give him that.
Also, he also did not give any indication as to why the individuals were let go in the first place. Because up until that moment, they were his closest confidants who had been with him the administration hasn't been around for that long, but even prior to the White House, they had all worked together very closely. So to have four of your closest people turn on you in a weekend seems like maybe something happened.
I agree. Something happened.
Yeah, I mean, well, he wasn't put in his position to lead Pete Hegseth. He was put in that position to make sure that the largest budget in the largest departmental budget in the overall American governmental budget, to make sure that money went to the right companies in the war economy, and to be an actor. All of the figureheads of these various departments are chosen because they can toe the Trump line. They've taken the blood oath or whatever, and they have sworn fealty to his whims, to his, what did you call it, impulsive governance. Yeah. They have all bought into that, not for the purpose of legitimate governance, not for the purpose of public safety and security, but solely to protect billions of dollars of private industry that is glossed over with the veneer of governmental legitimacy.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right, but I'll also say the world is complex, and if you're Trump or his advisors, at least you have to recognize that the world is complex, and getting people in. I think there are some critical DOJ, the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, a little bit more important than perhaps the Secretary of the Interior or Transportation and that sort of thing. That said, it's not, if you look back on the history of our Secretary of Defenses, or Secretaries of Defense, I should say, those are serious people who understand the complexity of the world.
Mm-hmm.
Hegseth is not that person. And so to just be fast and loose and prefer the media savvy individual in that position actually means lives are in jeopardy.
And again, even from a media perspective, he was not doing a good job on that Fox News interview. He was sweating. He was talking very quickly. He was repeating the same points again and again, and he was not offering a cogent explanation for why he was where he was. You know, I just hope that at this point, everybody at the Pentagon has agreed we're not going to let him. We're going to ice him out of important military maneuvers because he just likes to brag to his wife and his friends about what's happening until this is resolved. Do I think that's actually happening? No, but that's my wish for the day.
So then, let me ask the panel: Is Hegseth, because Hegseth, in not denying that he did it, but blaming it on others, whether it's his buddies who he fired or whatever, is Hegseth Trump's biggest disappointment?
Maybe today.
Or liability, and the one that he put the most capital into, right? I mean, to send the vice president up to cast the final vote and was all in. And not only that, but it's hard not to editorialize in this moment, but then also to really clear the way for the other, dare I say, other problematic members of the cabinet who then were fairly easily put in office.
No, I think that's true, but you know, I wonder what the conversations are like in the Oval Office about what I'm going to describe as disappointments, because Besant must be a disappointment to him because he tapped the head and said we need to leave the party. Elon Musk must be somewhat of a disappointment to him at the moment because at the end of the day, he didn't put $2 trillion back in the American pocket. He put, you know, whatever, 1.5 billion, whatever the number is. So there's a whole host of disappointments. Hegseth, I still think, has Trump's support in part because of the fact that he has that media skill that he didn't demonstrate the other day.
I think Musk still has support among Trump supporters, though, who think that, as Sarah noted, they wanted everything shook up. They wanted change, and Musk has brought that to the table.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation, finish up with this great group. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. First, we'll check in and get news from the BBC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Bo Breslin, Judy Patrick, and Sarah Rogerson making up the group. And we will, we're continuing our conversation this morning. And we have about, 10, 12 minutes left, and try to get to as much as we possibly can in that time. We are another story that obviously we've been talking a lot about when it comes to immigration and the efforts by the Trump administration recently. Now another round of firings hit immigration courts in Massachusetts, California, and Louisiana as the Trump administration continues its twin efforts of downsizing the government and increasing immigration-related arrests. Yes. At least eight immigration judges received notices that they would be on leave and their employment would be terminated on April 22nd, according to two people familiar with the firings and to the International Federation of Professional and Technical Engineers Union. That represents the immigration judges. Does that make sense? So that union is the representer? Okay. Doesn't seem like they'd be technical engineers, but I'll let that go. The judges who received notices weren't given a reason for the terminations. They were at the end of their two-year probationary period with the Executive Office for Immigration Review, and which is part of the Justice Department. They have declined to comment on personnel matters. So what is afoot here, Sarah?
Well, if the way that due process is defended and administered is through the court system and a hearing on the merits, then you kill the courts, bloat the dockets, and then use the bloated dockets as an excuse to dispense with due process in the interest of government efficiency. They do it all the time. This was the last Trump administration had rocket dockets, prioritized sort of last in, first out asylum applications, right? Like that, the system's so broken, they can do whatever they want with it. It's a sandbox of corruption at this point. Our immigration system is beyond. So they, you know, the courts are in the DOJ. The attorney general has statutorily granted authority over any immigration case anywhere in the country. Congress hasn't fixed that, and this Congress won't. So we're sort of bearing witness to a very public display of a rejection of due process, which is a core tenet of our constitutional democracy, on the backs of immigrants.
So, Sarah, let me ask you this question. They're not Article III judges, right? They're
nope.
They have 15-year appointments, and they're appointed by the DOJ. To what extent do you think this is a, to use Joe's term, a low-hanging fruit, easy vengeance moment for him to get at judges generally?
Yeah, undoubtedly. Immigration judges, for sure. And then that sends a message to people who don't know the special sort of unique situation of immigration judges in our justice system. Yeah, it's a slam dunk on all types of fronts for the Trump administration. I don't know why they wouldn't. Also, we know that asylum grants vary widely by justice to justice, immigration judge by immigration judge. So you could have like five judges sitting in the same courthouse and have wildly different outcomes for asylum seekers based largely on gender as one key indicator. In my experience, it doesn't matter who appointed the judge. It's how willing they are to believe people's suffering. So, you know, they're probably also, I meant to look this up, but I couldn't get deep enough last night to dig into the stats of who, or even to find out who was let go. But I would suspect that they have some of the higher grant rates for asylum seekers as well.
Clearly, this makes no sense, correct? We have a immigration court system that has been backlogged for
decades.
Many decades.
Yep.
We've been writing about this for years and years and years, and the solution has always been we need more judges. I mean, that is so illogical, so the correct way to approach this problem. But clearly, as Sarah points out, this is not a problem they want to resolve. This is a problem they want to push out across the border to some other country. Congress needs to stand up. As we've said this before, you know, Congress needs to address this problem, and Congress needs to stand up for it. It's mind-blowing how illogical this is. And the fact that it deals with the immigration justice system means it's not going to get a lot of play. I mean, it's not top of mind. Hegseth is a far sexier topic, but it's something that we really do need to address.
Yeah, the goal is to deport as many people as possible. The goal isn't
right.
to deport the is the not right. the administration yeah. of the immigration justice system.
But, you know, they're just trying to all the women to have more babies, but those babies are not going to replace all those poor, undocumented workers fast enough to keep our economy going.
We also can't deport everyone who is undocumented. There's just not. I think that the article that you're referring to, Joe, had a quote about, you know, how many hours or days or years it would take to give
yes.
everyone a hearing
yes.
in
yeah.
the United States. And so they're saying, all right, well, let's dispense with that.
Well, and Donald Trump even said it's impossible. We can't give everyone a trial.
Yeah.
It'll take 200 years. It's the president has come right out and said, not everybody can have a trial. Well, that's what our country is about, is everybody gets a trial.
Yeah, and I think the what's fascinating to me is the attempt to raise, as in R-A-Z-E, right, raise the institutions in America that, you know, not all of them, but most of the institutions in America that have in some way pissed him off. Like, Joe, the companion story here is the fact that he signed the executive order about the accreditation of higher ed. There's a reason why he did that, not just because he wants a particular new level of accreditation organizations coming up, but also because Trump University was not accredited.
Right.
And so, you know, these institutions, Sarah, that's why I was asking, these institutions, whether they be the judiciary, higher ed, Smithsonian accreditation organizations, and these sorts of things, have all in some way poked the bear, and he's now he's using it as an opportunity to completely destroy those and rebuild them in his image.
And it's only day 94.
He's also getting really bad press in the federal courts about these high-profile deportations that happened. There are some federal judges who are being very clear about the overreach of the federal government in these cases and the danger of that. I guess you... probably not every American is reading those orders every day, but, you know, I get them in my inbox automatically through immigration professor networks. And it isn't surprising to me that he's decided to go in this direction to bring attention away from what's happening in more legitimate federal district courts against his immigration policies.
Since you brought it up, though, the fact that the Trump administration is floating the idea of giving women $5,000 if they have a baby.
And a medal if you have more than six.
Yeah.
Joe's speechless.
Like, check please, I'm done. Like, how does that... what?
Yeah, it's all about the patriarchy, I think.
Well, it certainly sounds that way.
Yeah, women should be home. Men should be out working in these great jobs where they get, you know, these great manufacturing. Put them back in the steel plants. We definitely do just want to go back into the 1940s and 1950s.
Well, and are we getting to a point where, you know, you'll get $10,000 if it's a girl baby?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, I just, I don't get it. I mean, I get it. I just don't want to get it.
I think they have to do. I think they have to do things every once in a while to like remind their core base that they are still their guys.
Yeah. Meanwhile, they're defunding Head Start. They're defunding all sorts of programs that help living children. The children are exactly existing to help them get good educations, to help them eat well, to help them stay healthy, not get the measles. I mean, care for the children that actually are living and out there now instead of this ideal version of June Cleaver. Well, June had more than – she only had two children. But, you know, the Partridge Family. No, that's
and
not
really,
a good one either.
And really
Brady
good
Bunch.
Male writers.
Brady Bunch.
Yeah.
Right. It's Gulf of Mexico, Mount McKinley. You know, you throw out some crazy stuff and – it either deflects or softens some of the other stuff around him. It's what I call the buckshot method. Like, I couldn't believe, Joe, that a week or two into his administration, he's doing all these executive orders, and then he comes out and he says that black South Africans ought to give the land back to Afrikaners. Like, where did that come from? In the same way that where does all this stuff come from?
But in the McKinley Gulf of America, I mean, those both became reality.
And I think he thinks some of these things, like $5,000 for childbirth, is gonna come to reality. I do.
And what is it, six? You get if you get a
medal,
dozen,
maybe a presidential medal of
freedom
of childbirth or a motherhood, or I don't.
And my understanding is that it's tens of thousands of dollars just to bring a child into the world. Like, I mean, in other words, $5,000 is gum money.
It ain't cheap.
Diaper money, maybe.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's just that doesn't even.
I hear Elon Musk is in for a big payday on that one, though.
I don't even know where to go from here. I want to remind folks that we're going to be in Oneonta a week from yesterday. It's an exciting visit. We're going to be at Hartwick College, and we are going to be visiting with the Hartwick Institute of Public Service. We'll be talking to many of their students, as well as the three co-directors of the institute. We will be talking about democracy and local and state government and civic engagement and legal education. And it's also April 30th, so it is 100 days of the Trump administration, and I'm sure we will talk about that as well. It's all happening at Hartwick College's Shineman Chapel House in partnership with the Hartwick Institute of Public Service, April 30th, 8:30 to 10:30. Show starts at 9 to 10:30 on air, and we would love to have you. You can get a ticket. It's $50 per ticket. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org. There's a link there, WAMC.org. Judy, Bo, and Sarah, thank you so much for being with us. A delight to have you on the program. As always, thank you for sharing your thoughts. We'll be back right after this.